We are Cambridge.
Cambridge Radio.
Welcome to the third episode of ACT's Amazing People. I'm Gavin Richards.
And I'm Danny Smith.
And today it feels as though we're gazing into the future.
But it's actually happening right now in our wonderful city of Cambridge.
And we're going to be learning about robotic surgery through the experiences of those pioneering it at Addenbrooke's Hospital.
And from the perspective of a patient whose life it has changed.
With some science to blow your mind today and an inspirational personal health journey. It is ACT's Amazing People on Cambridge Radio. So, Danny, we're on our third episode already. Can you believe it?
No, it's flown by and I've loved it. I've loved all of the episodes. It's been great. Everyone we've had a chance to talk to.
And we've got some really exciting interviews lined up for you today. We're going to be talking all about robotic surgery, how it works, how it differs from open or keyhole surgery and the inroads it is making here in Cambridge at Addenbrooke's. But it's really exciting to think that something that wouldn't even have been around more than 30 years ago is now possible. Here we are in 2025 talking about something that would have felt like something straight from a sci-fi movie if it had been talked about when we were growing up. In the studio today, are two eminent robotic surgeons, along with one of their patients who underwent robotic surgery in January this year. And I think eminent is the right word here, isn't it, Danny?
Yeah, they're both sitting a foot away from me, so I have to say yes. But absolutely, definitely, we're really, really lucky to have them. Really, really pleased to see them here today, along with their patient.
And their patient, who has very kindly agreed to come in, will be talking to us about what it was like to undergo robotic surgery and a little bit about their recovery too. But before we give our official welcome to all our guests, what's been happening in the world of ACT, Danny?
Well, it's our official 30th birthday month throughout July, so we're still there just about, but obviously we'll be celebrating through the year. And, you know, apart from the fact that we fund lots of groundbreaking research and state-of-the-art equipment, we also kind of do things for the staff as well. And one of the things that we do that we love is lay on a staff barbecue every July. And we celebrated our 30th at the start of this month with them. Had a lovely birthday cake from Fitzbillies, and also Jack Gelato's donated some free gelato, so that was very nice to celebrate that and just talk about with staff about some of the amazing work that we can help fund through the hospitals.
And although July is your official birthday month, will you still be celebrating through the rest of the year?
Absolutely. And we're trying to get people, anyone who wants to fundraise, there's a very easy way to do it. But we can also host a tea party for ACT or for Adam, host a tea party for Addenbrooke's, I should say. So you can fundraise, donate, volunteer, sign up to a special event like the Cambridge Half, the London Marathon, or next year we've got the Great Wall of China. There's a whole host of ways that people can help. So if you head to our homepage, go to www.act4addenbrooke's.org.uk.
I quite like the idea of this prolonged birthday celebration, Danny. It was my birthday the other day. Maybe I should celebrate for the rest of the year. But
you should. I didn't know that. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. But my family will probably chuck me out. And it was ACT supporters who were involved in fundraising for one of the latest Da Vinci robotic surgical systems we're going to be talking about today, wasn't it?
Yeah, we will introduce our guests shortly. We're looking forward to them. But yeah, just to give you a bit of a background, in 2021, before I started at ACT, they launched a 1.5 million public appeal to buy the new system. And it was a real community effort. Everybody around the community got involved, fundraised. We also had Atano, who came, he spoke on our first show. He's one of the robotic surgeons. He did a run around Cambridge using Strava, which spelt out the word robot, so he got involved too. And the system arrived at Addenbrooke's in 2023. So it's been making a real headway since then. So yeah, really looking forward to speaking to the surgeons today about, you know, what difference it's made at the hospital. And obviously we'll also be talking to Stephanie, one of the patients, who is I've described her as the interview's dream. She's a real live wire with an amazing story behind her. And when I say amazing, I don't mean that to take away from what she's gone through. Obviously she's had a lot to deal with, but it's just kind of how it's unfolded. And she describes herself as very lucky. So Stephanie, we'll introduce you shortly.
So shall we introduce them all before we go into the first song choice of the show, Danny?
Yeah, let's do it.
So we have live in our studio today Mr. Siong Lau, Chair of the Robotic Steering Group at Addenbrooke's and Consultant Hepatobiliary and Pancreatic Surgeon. Did I get that right?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's good. With one of his patients, Stephanie Hemming, who has very kindly agreed to come in today to talk about what it was like to undergo robotic surgery. We've also got Mr. Michael Power, a Consultant Colorectal Surgeon within the robotic surgery team, also at Addenbrooke's. Hello to all of you.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Thank you.
And we should say that although we've introduced both our surgeons as robotic surgeons, you do also perform open surgery as well as keyhole, don't you?
Yes, absolutely.
And as all the regular listeners on the show know, hopefully we've got some regular listeners by now, episode three, we do ask all our guests to introduce a song of their choice. Doesn't matter why they've chosen it. It could be personal reasons, something that connects them to work. So we have Michael. You've chosen your first song.
I have, yes, and I've gone for If I Can Dream by Elvis Presley. Part of the reason I picked this song, I saw it performed on television by Elvis as a child, and I remember being mesmerised by the powerful performance. And I've always loved this song. It's a song I've gone back to throughout my life. It's about hope, it's about resilience, it's about grit. It's about getting through things, and also... I find it applies to a healthcare setting because it talks about people working together, community setting, collaboration to make things better. So I love this song, and I hope you do too.
Is it true you're going to be singing along in the studio, Michael, or is that a vicious rumour?
No, only on mute, only on mute. I think your readership, your listenership will decrease as a consequence.
We'll enjoy Elvis Presley on Cambridge Radio Acts Amazing People.
Flying higher in a sky more blue. If I can dream of a better land where all my brothers walk hand in hand, tell me why, oh why, oh why can't my dream come true? Oh why? Understanding sometime, strong winds of promise that will blow away the doubt and fear. If I can dream of a warmer sun where hope keeps shining on everyone, tell me why, oh why, oh why won't that sun? In a cloud with too much rain, we're trapped in a world that's troubled with pain. But as long as a man has the strength to dream, he can redeem. The answer's gonna come somehow. Out there in the dark, there's a beckoning candle, yeah. And while I can think, while I can talk, while I can stand, while I can walk, while I can dream, oh, please let my dream come true.
Acts Amazing People on Cambridge Radio. It's Elvis Presley. I'm not familiar with that song, really, Danny. Were you?
No, I love it, though.
It's good, isn't
it's
it?
Got a nice
what
story
a song.
It.
Yeah, Michael was regaling us with the backstory during that, which did distract him from singing. So it may not have been altogether a bad thing. I'm going to look into that a little bit more. So, Seong and Michael, it would be great to hear a little bit more about where you trained, how long you've been practicing, what brought you to Addenbrookes, that kind of thing. Seong, shall we come to you first? Just tell us a bit of your backstory. Story.
Well, I did my medical school training in Edinburgh, and my basic surgical training was in Edinburgh as well. And then I moved out south to Cambridge, where I did my higher surgical training. Following that, I spent a year in Toronto where I did a fellowship in hepatobiliary surgery and multi-organ transplantation. And I decided to come back to Cambridge, really attracted by the group of consultant surgeons that I have with me currently. Really a bunch of liver surgeons and pancreatic surgeons who are really dedicated to their work and very cohesive team. And that's actually brought me back to Cambridge. And I've been here ever since. So I've been in practice for the last 24 years and delighted to be part of the team in Edinburgh.
So you're part of the Cambridge furniture, it sounds like, then, Siong. Michael, what's your backstory?
Yeah, so I've been a doctor in the NHS for 28 years now. I went to medical school in Nottingham and then did most of my surgical training in and around London, both South and North London. I spent a year in Brisbane at the Royal Brisbane Hospital, which was a great year, both professionally, where I did a high volume of keyhole surgery, but also as a family. My children were 6 and 4 at the time, so it was a great year for us all. And then joined Adam Brooks in 2012, and I've been there as a consultant for the last 13 years.
And obviously, with the robot campaign, this was happened before I started at ACT, but we launched the 1.5 million public campaign to buy the latest Da Vinci robotic system. It's a Da Vinci Xi, is that how you say it?
Xi.
Oh, you say it? Yeah. Oh, I wasn't sure. Okay, that's great, Xi. That was back in 2021, and it was unveiled on the 5th of July 2023 for the 75th anniversary of the NHS. Now, Siong, you'd already had another robot at that stage, so what was the reason for needing the latest robot?
Well, at that stage, we had a single system, which is an old version of Da Vinci, very much dedicated towards urology as a service, and it was very heavily utilized by that specialty. And there was a group of surgeons who were really interested in developing robotic surgery further, but in other specialties. And that was the main reason that we actually fundraised and essentially pushed for the next system to be available at Adam Brooks. And you see the difference that is made in the last 2 years or so. We've been able, with the new system, to develop 6 services. In fact, we are probably one of the few in the country with multiple specialties utilizing and delivering robotic surgery in the space of the last 2 years or so. And that's been really helpful in expanding the availability of robotic surgery to other patients in other specialties, apart from urology, which mm-hmm. what you started forth in Adam Brooks.
Mm. We will ask you a little bit more about that later as well, because I know you want to expand more. Before we talk about why this particular type of surgery is so pioneering and the difference it's making at Adam Brooks, can you tell us when robotic surgery was first introduced?
Well, historically, robotic surgery probably started off in the 90s, where two other specialties, for instance, neurosurgery, where the first experimentation to robotic surgery was based on robotic system helping with brain biopsies. And then that progressed to orthopedics for joint replacements. And by 2000, and that's when the first Da Vinci system came online, when it received the first FDA approval in the United States. And since then, Da Vinci has progressed and has undergone multiple iterations of improvement. And currently, we do have one of the state-of-the-art systems in Adam Brooks.
Is that the only make, when you say Da Vinci? There are other makes? Is that just like the state-of-the-art one?
There are other makes that have come online in the last couple of years, certainly in the last 5 years. And we do have a system called the Cambridge Medical Robotics based in Cambridge. There are other systems that are rapidly coming online as well. Essentially, the market is expanding.
Mm. Okay. And is it right that one of the reasons for robotic surgery being introduced was to help reduce movement to prevent sort of hand tremors?
That's one of the key advantages of robotic surgery. It's called tremor filtration.
I'd be like shaking around. I'd be no good. I can't even sort of chop a carrot half the time. So yeah.
Well, you can imagine how useful that simple thing would do, especially when you're dealing with structures during surgery which are so magnified. And essentially, you're able to do very precise movements with robotic surgery. And certainly, in certain types of operations where there are very important critical structures that you need to get right and actually tease it away from the areas that you're operating. Mm. And that's the key of that benefit from the robotic system.
So did you both train on robotic surgery systems prior to coming to Cambridge? And is it something that today's generation of medical students would automatically get some kind of exposure to?
Well, that's a good question. I personally have been exposed to robotic surgery during my time in Canada, where at that time, robotic surgery in liver and pancreatic surgery was at its infancy. And in fact, at that time, the real limiting factor is the technology. And over the last 5 years, I could see the progression of technology has really enabled us to do complex surgery with robotic system. So during my time in Toronto, a lot of my training was really based on almost in the lab setting. We were developing robotic surgery in that specialties. And following that, when I came back to Cambridge, I was very much interested and in developing robotic surgery further, and I went on several fellowships over the course of those years. I spent some time in Korea, where robotic surgery was really a popular modality of surgery, in the sense that they were very innovative surgeons in Korea. And that has helped me and inspired me really to develop that in Cambridge.
And obviously, I'm going to ask Michael this one. I've seen the Da Vinci in residence. Is that what you say? Do you call a robot in residence? I guess you do, don't you? And so I know what it looks like, but there's been a few occasions lately when I've said, oh, we're going to be talking to some robotic surgeons. They're like, well, is that a robot who are surgeons? Or is it a surgeon that's doing robotic surgery? So for people, I mean, obviously it's a surgeon using a robot. Can you describe physically what the robot looks like for people who've not seen it?
Sure, Danny. It is fascinating. A lot of patients will assume a metal Mickey comes out of the corner and starts doing the operation. So it's very important to explain to them.
I mean, you look very human, we've got to say.
Thank you.
Yeah. AI is amazing these days,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Essentially, it's robotic-assisted surgery is probably a better way of describing it. So we are using a robotic platform to use instruments that are inserted into the patient that are human at a console controls. So we're in the operating theatre, we position the robot, we put the instruments in the right places, and then in the corner of the operating theatre is a surgeon console, and that has special hand controls that what we do with our hands are mimicked by the robotic instruments on the inside. We also, and this is the beauty of this platform, is we get an immersive three-dimensional view of inside the patient. And that has made a huge difference. As well as that, we control that view ourselves. So
can you zoom in and out? Obviously.
Yeah, so you can zoom in and out, you can turn left or right, and you have full control of that through foot pedals and a combination of hand controls as well. But what you're getting is a benefit of the robotic wristed instruments, which are these miniature instruments which are inside the patient. So as we move our wrists and our fingers on the outside in the special hand controls, those movements are mimicked and replicated on the inside of the patient.
So it's fascinating. You're not actually sitting at or standing at the patient's bedside. You're kind of sort of semi-detached from it all.
Well, we're in the corner. Parts of the operation still require us to be at the patient bedside, but it's a combination of both.
Is it like a kind of gamer's console or something? Can you do it on one of those Wii steering wheels or anything?
No, not quite. I have a son who's a gamer. It's not like a gaming chair. Yeah. It's a dedicated sort of piece of medical equipment. And as I said, it has a sort of headset which allows you to get an immersive three-dimensional view. You have controls. You have foot pedals. You have hand controls. You have energy controls because we use certain devices inside the patient as
energy
well.
Energy controls.
Yeah, so... We're using energy to cut tissue or ablate tissue, and so therefore we use our fingertips, but also the foot pedals to do that.
Oh, this sounds a very fine controller. But so being good at Mario Kart Wii in itself isn't good enough.
It will help, but like I suppose hand-eye coordination, so racket sports, other things, you know, they all have their benefit in surgery.
I don't think this is my career, Danny. I think that ship has sailed for me.
I've got two questions now. This is what, when you start hearing people talk. So when you did you have to learn new movements with your hands? It feels like you've got to learn how to turn them and spin them.
So we're still doing the same operation we've done by other keyhole methods. So it's not relearning an operation, it's just using a tool in a different fashion.
And with the movements of your hands, though.
So again, there are part of the training is a lot of simulation work. So you do the simulation exercises in a computer environment. Mm-hmm. We also do other training courses that are on sort of fabricated equipment. So a lot of those movements are natural movements you would use during surgery anyway.
Okay.
So it's not a completely alien concept.
Okay. And I don't know if this is like the correct analogy or not, but to me, when I saw the arms, they're almost a bit spider-like because they expand out like spider legs. So I guess a bit to increase the area of movement. But one thing I was going to ask you about, there's obviously multiple arms at the same time. Do you ever need to use more than one arm at a time, or do you focus on one and then the others are held there holding the equipment?
No, so most of the time we're using at least three arms simultaneously.
Yeah. So you're moving three arms?
So we're certainly moving two arms, and the third arm is the camera arm. And then with the foot pedal, you're able to switch between arms. So it is, and this is why it's robotic assisted. You know, usually you will only have two hands to operate with and have an assistant holding the camera, and an assistant will show you what they're looking at, not necessarily what you need to look at, whereas you're controlling the camera during a robotic operation. So all three arms are in play, usually simultaneously, and then the fourth arm is periodically used to hold tissue and move it.
Well, it sounded highly skilled before I even knew anything about it. Now my mind is blown. And Danny touched on the fact that one of the reasons robotic surgery was introduced was to try and kind of stop hand tremors. Has it helped overall? Do you get hand cramps or something by doing such fine kind of control? Is it difficult?
So although one of its benefits is sort of potentially limiting hand tremor, most surgeon hand tremor is not a particular issue, would be my feeling. The real benefit of the platform is its precision, its wristed instruments, the view, the stability. And the instruments on the outside are so ergonomically designed that hand cramp is not an issue. And in fact, sitting at a console in the operating theatre in the corner is actually better for the surgeon. There's evidence to show it increases surgeon longevity, because operating at the side of a patient for several hours in a fixed position can cause all sorts of neck and back problems. So actually, it's better for surgeon longevity rather than causing problems.
Oh, that's good. And presumably the robotic hands have more movement and can perhaps move in more complex ways than a human hand.
That's right. They can move in 7 degrees of freedom, it's called. So much more than a human wrist can.
So obviously it's fantastic that Addenbrooke's has these robotic surgical systems. Sion, can you just give us a sense of what is so pioneering and unique overall about this, and how it perhaps is different or advantageous from open or keyhole surgery?
Well, the most dramatic benefit that we see really is for the patient. Now we're able to do complex operations to little scars compared to previous operations where there will be a big wound. With a large wound, for instance, patients would have more pain, more discomfort, and therefore, prolonged recovery. Whilst in patients where they have the keyhole robotic operations in particular, recovery is much faster. And that, as a consequence of less complications, we hope. And the important thing is that there's now evidence to suggest that some of the cancer resections, for instance, which I'm sure Mike will cover at some point, is that, for instance, rectal cancer randomized controlled trials is showing some evidence of improved cancer outcome.
And when you say resection, can you explain what that is?
Resection is essentially surgery to remove a particular part or an organ, for instance, mostly cancers.
So there's better outcomes since using the robots?
Correct.
Fantastic. Okay, so coming up, we're going to be talking about some of the firsts that Addenbrooke's has been able to achieve thanks to having the new Da Vinci Xi system. But before we do that, we would like to introduce Stephanie, who's been sitting there very listening in very, very patiently. Thank you, Stephanie. You underwent a pretty major operation earlier this year, performed by yourself, Siong. First of all, thank you ever so much, Stephanie, for coming in to share your story today. How does it feel to be sat next to Siong, knowing that he is the surgeon that performed your life-saving surgery?
I'm going to say that I've always looked forward to seeing Mr. Lau, genuinely, because he's he's a great guy. And honestly, I've never thought, oh, I've got to go into the hospital. I've always thought, I'm very disappointed when it's just a phone call if you want to tell them the truth. So there you are, I'm delighted.
No, it's lovely because all our fundraisers that get involved with that, all of them have a story, a personal story about their health journey. And every single one of them mentions the name of the consultant, the staff that helped them. So it is really important to people. But it did make me smile when I spoke to you earlier this week where you said, you know, although it's a strange thing to say, I look forward to seeing my surgeon. I did actually look forward to my surgeon. It was lovely. So your surgery was 6 months ago, back in January.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the surgery was called and what was done? And see when you can jump in as well to join in.
Well, I don't know the technical term for what it was called, but I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer towards the end of 2024. I heard the diagnosis just before Christmas that year, and the operation was on the 22nd of January, so it was quite quick. And I don't, I'll be put right if I'm wrong, but obviously I knew it was a small cancer. I already knew that. I knew I was very lucky to catch it at that stage, and that was real good luck. But what I didn't know was what would be literally involved. And in fact, talking to Mr. Lau earlier, I think until we're cut open, even you didn't know precisely what you were going to find there. And even small cancers can sometimes be in very difficult positions. Or I think you described it as having like tentacles, did you? Or yes. Something.
No, absolutely. So Stephanie's, although it's a small cancer, but it's actually located in a very awkward position of the pancreas, where it's surrounded by some very important structures, essentially blood vessels that supply the majority of the blood to the liver. And the operation really involves removing that part of the pancreas, what we will call a subtotal pancreatectomy, as well as splenectomy. The reason for removing that part of the pancreas plus the spleen is to ensure that we get a complete cancer clearance as far as possible.
And was it right, when I spoke to Stephanie on the phone, she thinks it's about 80% of her pancreas was removed, as well as the entire spleen, is that right?
It's roughly about 70 to 80%, yep.
Wow. And something that really struck home when I was speaking to her as well, she said when you came to the hospital bed after the operation, the way you described it was you said she had surgery at the limit of what a human body can stand. I mean, that just blew my mind.
And I think the difficulty with Stephanie's operation was really that where the position of the cancer was, and it involves the surgeons teasing away some of these structures so that we could perform the surgery safely. And historically, just moving a couple years back, we would have attempted this in a keyhole straight stick laparoscopy technique, and that would have been very difficult to perform for Stephanie's operation. And the benefit of robotic surgery in this particular instance was that we were able to do and dissect or tease out tissues of this tumour away from these vessels in a really, really tight and awkward positions. And robotic surgery has made that very easy to do and hopefully as safe as possible as well.
So it sounds quite dramatic to say that, and I'm sure entirely justified to say this was surgery at the limit of what a human body can stand. What were the risks and potential complications involved with it all, Siong?
Well, one of the most feared risks of any pancreatectomy or removal of part of the pancreas is bleeding as a result of leakage of pancreatic juice. And the pancreas is involved in producing enzymes or things that help you digest food. And similarly, if it's leaking inside the abdomen, you will digest vessels. And in particular, Stephanie's case, the majority of the operation was meant to take out part of the pancreas, but avoiding these very critical structures. And I'm sure Stephanie will mention that later on, that one of the precautions that we put was after the operation, she would have a drain. And that's what Stephanie would probably tell you is the most annoying thing, apart from having such a major operation.
So, Stephanie, let's turn back to you. And you had the operation because you were diagnosed with pancreatic cancer back in December last year. But you didn't actually have any symptoms, did you? How did you come to be diagnosed? How did you discover this?
Well, sign of some good luck and some bad luck. I had heart surgery in last August, just nearly a year ago, where I had a valve replacement and actually, again, benefited from modern technology because I had it while I was conscious. I had a TAVI procedure, so I had it. And again, I might have had a scar from top to bottom, and I might have had a cut scar from side to side. Who knows if it hadn't been for current, you know, modern technology. But what happened is I had a bit of a sort of twingy bit of pain probably 2 weeks after I'd had heart surgery. So I'm not an alarmist person at all. So I just rang the doctor and said, do you think I should pop in? And he said, no, I think you should call an ambulance, which I did.
Gosh.
And did my usual, you know, the wait in A&E and so on. And they obviously looked at everything related to the heart surgery, like blood clots and so on. Couldn't find anything. But I did have a marker in my blood test to show amylase?
Amylase, yeah.
Okay. So... and they sort of pursued that, and I won't go through all the sort of tests I had, but eventually they said I had a stricture in my pancreas, but still I think not diagnosed, it wasn't diagnosed as cancer at that stage. And then you go through all the various scans, including MRI and so on. But eventually we got there and the appointment was made to see Mr. Lau in December.
So you've described yourself as lucky when you were speaking then. And it's a word I'd sort of always associate with someone who's needed heart surgery. But I guess you counted yourself lucky in that you discovered this additional problem quite early on as a result.
Had I not had the heart surgery, I would have had a few twinges. I'd have probably taken some indigestion tablets. If it had persisted, I might have seen the doctor and they would have probably treated me not for that. They would have given me various other things until they decided, and by which time it may well have been too late. So the only reason I ended up in Addenbrookes as quickly as I did is because I had heart surgery. So in a sense, the heart surgery actually saved my life in three ways. One, because I identified Mr. Lau said if I hadn't had that surgery, you would have discovered that I'd got it in all the pre-tests before the operation. They wouldn't have been able to operate.
Just bring the microphone just a tiny bit closer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, just so you're.
I was looking at Mr. Lau.
I know you're turning to Mr. Lau, and he's sort of he doesn't pick up the sound quite so well.
No. Oh, really? You could do everything. There you go.
Okay. So can we ask you how you are now with the cancer, and also how you feel?
I feel great. I'm doing everything I think I was doing before I had the surgery. I don't think there's anything. I tried to obey all the rules that were given me and all the instructions and so on and so forth. And I'm not saying it wasn't a difficult time, particularly when I came out of hospital. That was in some ways more difficult than being in hospital, because you're surrounded by people who can help you, I suppose, when you're there. But by now, and the only thing I haven't done this year, I usually do something like Cambridge Open Studios, which is quite demanding, and I haven't done that this year. But other than that, I think I've done everything that I did previously. And I do feel good, and I do feel positive, and it doesn't cross my mind that anything bad is going to happen to me. I think it's all going to be good. I'm not giving it a moment's thought.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I was going to ask you a little bit about, as well, we touched about the drain as well. I was going to ask you what it was like at the time, because obviously a big part of having robotic surgery is that the incisions are much smaller, so patients have much less risk of infection that's associated with open surgery. Were you in pain after the surgery?
Do you know, I remember so little, not because I was doped or anything, but because it's a kind of, I think, a mechanism for, like, people have two, they wouldn't have two children if they remembered the birth one, would they?
Exactly.
But so you kind of, you don't remember all those things. But I can honestly say that I'm genuinely not aware of being in pain. Now, that will partly be presumably to the fact that I had quite small wounds. And the second thing is because there's obviously pain control in the hospital, so I don't know what that would have been, but I mean, there were all sorts of drips and lines, so I'm assuming some of that would have been pain control. I can honestly say that I was never in, I might have been in some discomfort from time to time, but I was never in pain. And the only pain I had was from that blooming drain, which was so sore by the time it was taken out. And every time you took a step, you'd, right. So I'm actually, as for the operation, no, I really didn't. And Mr. Lau know better than I whether it was partially pain control or partially the fact that the wounds were relatively small.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you a little bit about some of the medication now as a result of the operation. And Sion can jump in if I get this wrong. I looked it up. Had to look up. You feel like you talk about the pancreas all the time, but you still have to look up what it does. Yeah, so the pancreas.
You talk about the pancreas all the time, do you, Danny?
Well, I kind of do in my job a little bit, actually.
You must be fun at parties.
I didn't know where it was, and I consider myself quite well informed, so, you know.
So is it right? So the pancreas digests and absorbs nutrients from food, and then the spleen, which was removed entirely, Sion's nodding, this is good, affects the immune system. So what are the after effects of having those removed? You want certain medication you have to take, isn't there?
Yes. So because I've had, I've got not a lot of pancreas left, I take a, it's a supplement, I can't even call it a drug really, I think it's a supplement, which replaces the enzymes that my pancreas would otherwise have produced. And that means if you're having a meal, you take two, and if you're having a snack, you take one, and you've got a little pot in your bag just in case somebody offers you a chocolate biscuit. Sorry about the chocolate biscuits. but, you know, you'd take one then. Mm-hmm. So I take...
So you take that every time you eat?
Yes.
Wow.
And that actually is the hardest thing to remember sometimes, because sometimes you just automatically take something and suddenly think... the other things that I'm taking is I have some other drugs that are more associated with the heart, which is like taking aspirin every day and so on. I'm just about to come off the blood thinners. And I think the only other thing that I will be taking for the rest of my life related to this surgery, I'm on antibiotics, and I'll have to take those for life morning and night. That has had, as far as I'm aware, no ill effect. I've been somebody who's avoided antibiotics if I can, and I don't think it's a good thing to have to take them all your life, but... And I'm vaccinated against things like meningitis.
So you're a bit more vulnerable to certain things.
More than a bit more, I think. I mean, I'm much more likely to get sepsis than somebody like you would be if I were to get a wound that got infected. So I have to be a bit more careful, more than a bit maybe. And I have to tell the dentist, things like that, because of bleeding. Mm. You know, your gums are very vulnerable. Your mouth is a vulnerable place to get infection. And... things like that. So it will and does affect me on a day-to-day basis, but has it had a really detrimental effect? The answer's no, and we'll find out whether all these drugs help my spleen in the end. But I think there are other parts of the body that also play a part in the immune system, so I'm hoping, you know, one of the things that when I was in hospital they told me was I'm type 3, never heard of it before, type 3 diabetic. And I was put on metformin when I first about. In fact, I'm off it because it caused my blood sugar to be too low, and I'm drug free for diabetes at the moment, which is another little miracle, isn't it? But I've got a sensor on my arm so that I will know that if I'm in trouble for that, there's potential there for that.
So I should ask you, Stephanie, what kind of went through your mind when you knew you were going to be operated on by a robotic surgical system? Because it all sounds a bit sci-fi. Was it reassuring, or was it scary thinking that a human wasn't going to be kind of directly doing this?
Well, a human was directly involved, I think. I always thought it was that.
Well, yeah, you know what I mean.
But it never occurred to me that I was being operated on by a machine, I have to say. And I didn't know a lot about, I knew a little bit, but I didn't know a lot about robotic surgery. But what gives you faith in what's happening to you, for me at least, and I think for many people, is not the machinery, but the person. And I had absolute faith in Mr. Lau.
And we've got two incredible people here in the studio today. And you also talked about feeling very lucky to have been treated here in Cambridge.
When I was younger, I used to think I'd end up living in Cornwall because I'm very into art. And I now know that Cambridge is flat and has Addenbrooke, so that's exactly what you need when you're old.
We can sacrifice the odd hill, can't we, for Addenbrooke?
I'll give up on the sea, yes.
And obviously, for supporters of ACT, it's a really positive thing to hear your story, because it's nice for people to know that every donation they make to ACT gets put towards some amazing kind of state-of-the-art equipment, like the robot.
I do urge people, I can't claim any fantastic powers of knowing that that was wrong with me. It was the last thing that crossed my mind when I went into Addenbrooke with feeling a bit sore. But I think one of the things that we often don't do is take some things seriously. And I think if something's unusual for you and it's persistent, I think you should push it, because it's not fair to expect people like these surgeons, not fair, it is fair, but it's much harder to present them with somebody who's well progressed down disease, and it's much more positive outcomes, I think, if we can get these things early. That's what I would say.
So before you go, Stephanie, I did want to ask you a little bit about your life outside of surgery, because you're quite mind-blowing, really, when you start talking to you. You've had a second career since retiring, haven't you, which you described as a bit of a Grandma Moses, and I had to Google that after I spoke to you. I didn't know what that meant.
You do now.
I do.
Because she was an old lady in America that somebody discovered was painting away in a little cottage somewhere in the Catskill Mountains or something. And she became famous for a short time.
In her late 70s, wasn't it?
In her late 70s, which is the same as me, isn't it? Oh. So, I've always drawn, and, you know, I've always had a bit of a talent for it, I have to say, and gone to various courses and bits and pieces and holidays, and hence the Cornwall thing. But when I had my own business for about 20 years, and when I was pushed by a friend, actually, talking about retirement, saying, why don't you start art again? And I did something for one day a week. I thought, I'll go to this little class. It nice group, and that was it. But somehow I'm a bit of a, not a fighter exactly, but I don't really like to do things by half. I'd rather do it not at all. And I've pursued it, and I'm going to say I got discovered. When I was young, I used to think I was going to get discovered a bit like these waitresses do in Hollywood, you know, and I'll make you a star. And I always thought I would be discovered for something, but of course, clearly I wasn't. And then somebody bought one of my paintings. I had exhibited a bit before then, but and she had a flat in London, has a flat in London, and her friend, great old friend, has a gallery, and just happened to go into this flat and said, I like that painting, can I? Would you mind if I contacted the artist? And now I'm allowed to say the name of the gallery.
Yes, and where it's being exhibited as well.
Okay, well, the lady's a lady called Karina Haslam, and she had a gallery at the time, during lockdown with some things happening, it doesn't matter, but she does a lot of international art exhibitions. So now my work's been sold in New York, and it's going to... I can't remember.
Did you say Singapore as well?
I can't remember if it's Singapore or Hong Kong. I'm going to
maybe
next,
it's both.
But anyway, and then back here for Battersea in the autumn.
Oh.
So I don't go with it, but it gets shipped. Mm. And so, incredibly, you know, my sort of moving towards 80, really, aren't I? But I just have kind of got, I would hardly call it fame, but a little bit of success.
Yeah,
perhaps.
That's lovely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story, Stephanie. And I don't know about you, Danny, but I think it's been quite emotional seeing Stephanie back in the company of Siong this morning, hasn't it?
Yeah, and can I just say that little bit extra as well, just sort of mentioning that the surgeons, obviously, they have to go through quite a lot to deal with people emotionally as well. I always think of that side
of
it.
Very good point. I always felt pleased for myself, but I also, I've told you this before, felt pleased for you, which is a bit patronising, but in the sense that I know how tough what you do is, and it must be very nice to have someone walk through your door smiling.
Mm. Is there anything you want to say to Siong on the radio today before you go?
I think I've said all my thank yous. You know. Saved my life. What am I going to say to someone? Thank you's not enough, is it?
Oh, it's an amazing story. And before you go, Stephanie, do you want to tell us about your song choice and why you've chosen it?
Well, it's not as deep a story, I'm afraid, as Michael's, but I've chosen a piece of music by the Buena Vista Social Club. And there are two reasons for it. One, it has got a backstory, because this was a group of musicians who were playing in the Buena Vista Social Club in Cuba. They were kind of just doing their thing there, and they were discovered, I think, they were discovered by someone called Ray Kuda. But the particular voice that I like is the voice of someone called Ibrahim Ferrer, who has that sort of slightly gruff, well, you'll hear it. And what does it remind me of? It reminds me of summer evenings in the garden with friends. That's what it reminds me of.
Well, thank you for joining us again today, Stephanie. We'll play your song now on Cambridge Radio for you.
Dos gardenias para ti, con ella quiero decir, te quiero, te adoro, mi vida, ponle toda tu atención. Que serán tu corazón y el mío. Dos gardenias para ti, que tendrán todo el calor
de un beso, de esos besos que te di y que jamás te encontrarán en el calor de otro querer. A tu lado vivirán y se hablarán como cuando estás conmigo, y hasta creerán que se dirá te quiero. Pero si un atardecer las gardenias de mi amor se mueren, es porque han adivinado que tu amor me ha traicionado, porque existe otro querer. A tu lado vivirán y se hablarán solo cuando estás conmigo, y hasta creerán que se dirán te quiero. Pero si un atardecer las gardenias de mi amor se es porque han adivinado que tu amor me ha traicionado, porque existe otro querer. Es porque han adivinado que tu amor me ha traicionado, porque existe otro querer.
So that's Dos Gardenias on Cambridge Radio by Ibrahim Ferrer. It is Act Amazing People. And I know we've talked about some of the firsts at Adam Brooks, that having this new Da Vinci robotic system has allowed its name, namely the Super Surgery Sunday. I read that as a Sugary Sunday before. I don't think you're probably not so into that, are you? But can you, Siong, tell us a little bit about the Super Surgery Sunday, perhaps?
Well, thank you. So as you all know, we do have a very long waiting list, certainly for benign conditions in NHS, certainly in Adam Brooks. What the robot has actually helped is to allow us to increase the efficiency of how many operations we can do in a day. So we've been able to complete 10 gallbladder operations in a day in two theatres synchronously with two robotic systems. And that's really helped us reduce the number of patients on the waiting list. And essentially, this is the first time they've been able to achieve that in Adam Brooks. And that's been really helpful for many patients, and some of them have been suffering for a long time in the waiting list, especially when they have benign, mostly gallstone disease, where they may historically not have had that priority compared to cases like cancer.
And there was another first in April, so if I ask you, Michael, about this one. It was the first double operation where what previously would have been two separate operations were done simultaneously on a 69-year-old cancer patient who underwent a robot-assisted joint, bowel and liver operation following colon cancer. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. This was a patient in the east of Anglia who unfortunately had developed a bowel cancer that had spread to his liver. He was initially treated with chemotherapy and responded well, and essentially needed an operation to remove the bowel cancer, but also the tumour in the liver. And usually that would have taken place as two sequential operations on two separate days, requiring two hospital stays, two theatre teams, and resulting in a combined length of stay in the hospital of up to 10 days. We were able to offer that patient surgery at Adam Brooks with myself and Mr. Liao, where we had the surgical teams, the anaesthetic teams, the theatre teams, all the specialist people in the operating theatre at the same time to perform this as a single operation or a single procedure where both parts of the operation were carried out. So, and the beauty of the robotic platform, again, was to be able to do this in a precise, speedy, efficient manner, And the patient went home less than 72 hours after their surgery. So a real bonus and benefit.
Wow. And I guess it's not just the medical impact as well. I guess it's all the emotional impact, sort of knowing that you're going in once instead of twice. And it's good.
Exactly. And the patient was very, very clear about that. He knew he was coming in for the single operation, knew everything was taking place at the same time. He didn't have the anxiety and anguish of two separate procedures, recovering from one, getting well enough to have the second operation, because that can take its time as well. And as I mentioned, there's a wider team involved, not only helping and supporting the patient preoperatively. We have our specialist nurses who help with that, but also the complexity of the theatre teams, and also care of the patient on the ward afterwards and helping them recover and get back to their loved ones and what's important to them in life.
Now, Sion, I was going to, I know you're very keen to get more robots for Addenbrookes because you'd like to establish the hospital as a centre of excellence. Can you tell people what that means exactly, and, you know, how that would fit into the rest of the UK? Would it kind of make us unique or one of?
Well, absolutely. One of the things that, because of the success of the programme, we now have almost a queue of surgeons waiting to be trained to offer this surgery. And unfortunately, we've reached a bottleneck where we cannot expand access further. And as I mentioned earlier, both the robotic systems, certainly Da Vinci's, are very heavily utilized right now. Mm-hmm. And we hope to expand the search the service one robot at a time. Mm-hmm. So we hope our next step will be to procure the next robotic system such that we can offer more robotic surgery in Addenbrookes to more patients, to more specialties as well.
I was going to say, is it to more specialties? Okay.
We've got to round off soon, and it's been such a pleasure to talk to you both today. It's been an absolute privilege to have you in the studio. Final couple of things. What's the atmosphere like in the operating theatre, especially when you're working with such complex technology? I mean, you must have to stay focused and alert for just such an extraordinary amount of time. How do you do it?
Well, I liken the process of robotic surgery, well, certainly in Addenbrookes, almost like an orchestra, a well-orchestrated symphony, where you have multiple members of the team doing their own respective roles and responsibility to ensure that the operation completes safely. Just apart from not having the music in the theatre, obviously, but one of the things that we've realized in the last 2 years is that it's so critical to train our staff members. And robotic surgery is no longer about the surgeon, it's about the team. And it's so critical to ensure that every single part of the team members are able, trained well to execute the process of robotic surgery. And that we've been very lucky in Addenbrookes that we have a huge and enthusiastic and motivated and well-trained team members perioperatively. And that has really helped us ensure the success of robotic surgery in Cambridge.
What about Michael? What's it like for you?
Yeah, I'd just like to sort of echo and emphasise that everyone knows why they're there. They're there for the patient to make things better. And that focuses people, but it also gives them a sense of camaraderie. And you work as a team together. And it's important that equally there's positive energy in the operating theatre. So it's it's not a sterile environment devoid of emotion. It's important. We're in the human business. We're in, you've heard so eloquently from Stephanie earlier talking about that. But everyone's pulling in the same direction, but it's important to have positive energy and people working together. And that camaraderie, both in and out of the operating theatre, is what makes Addenbrookes and healthcare and the NHS such a special place.
This feels like a really nice question to finish on as well. I always kind of wanted to, people sometimes have dreams when they're growing up. What did you both dream of being when you were growing up? Did either of you want to be surgeons?
So the first thing I wanted to be was an astronaut.
Really?
like most young people. And so that was first on my list. I soon after, I actually wanted to be a doctor, and I was.
How old were you then?
I was probably about 9 or 10 when I wanted to be a doctor, but I did some work experience actually at the age of 15 and saw a surgeon called Keith Porter, who is the sole reason I became a doctor. And later in my sort of career, I decided I wanted to be surgery, but he certainly inspired me. And believe it or not, going back to the astronaut element, There's even a little surgical robot on the International Space Center that they're doing work on, of actually trying to control it from Earth and seeing if I can carry out exercises.
Wow.
So you never know. In the future, maybe I'll be a robotic space surgeon.
It all comes together.
No.
Xiong, what were your dreams?
Well, I haven't got as interesting a reason as Michael, but growing up, very much like Stephanie, I enjoyed drawing, and I always drawn to a craft, specialty as such. But I also kind of very interested in the care profession. So medicine was a clear choice. Mm-hmm. And as I embarked on medicine, it was clear that I was really interested in surgery. And you mm-hmm. really see the impact of what you do to a patient. And that's really motivated me in surgery. Oh.
Did you play with robots as a kid?
That would be great if they said yes, wouldn't it?
Transformers.
Well, yes. Well, I hope what we're doing now and that will really inspire the future generations of medical students who want to do surgery. We need to continue to motivate and inspire the next generation.
I know it will, and it's certainly inspired us today. It's pretty much all we've got time for, though, and we'd like to say a huge thank you to all our guests today, to Xiong, Michael and Stephanie.
So before we go, we do need to give one more mention of our website, because every single donation that people make to ACT goes to a project like groundbreaking technology or pioneering research that goes on to save patients' lives. So things exactly like we've been talking about today, the Da Vinci Xi robotic surgery system. So if you feel inspired to help by donating, volunteering, fundraising or signing up for one of our events, Cambridge Half Marathon, London Marathon, the Dragon Boat Festival or next year's Great Wall of China, go to www.act4annabrooks.org.uk.
And thank you again to all our guests in the studio today. ACT's amazing people is now taking a short break for the summer, but we'll be back with even more inspiring stories in the autumn, won't we, Danny?
We will.
And thank you again for listening. It is Cambridge Radio. It has been ACT's amazing people. I'm Gavin Richards.
And I'm Danny Smith.
And we'll see you again soon. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.